Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Progressive political scientist Michael Parenti is back, and he's in fine form. Here he's speaking ad lib, and he's wise, shrewd, and funny. I hope you'll stay tuned. When I began New World Notes about 8 years ago, I expected to play a lot of political scientist Michael Parenti. In fact, we've played him less frequently than I expected, but we will hear from him again today. I have to thank Mariah Gilardin and her fine show TUC Radio for acquainting me with Parenti a couple decades back. Parenti helped me to make sense of a lot of random ideas and observations that I just couldn't get to add up. Ideas and observations about the U.S. government's domestic and especially foreign policies, which never made sense to me. Here are some of the clarifying ideas I got from Michael Parenti. First, don't conclude that U.S. foreign policy is stupid or crazy or counterproductive. People do things for a reason. And relatedly, don't confuse a government's statement of its noble motives and noble purposes for the real reasons behind a policy. Government policy seems stupid and crazy and counterproductive only if you believe the official statement of what its motives and purposes are. Like, the goal of U.S. foreign policy is to promote freedom and democracy around the world. The goal of our military interventions is to protect American lives. We bombed the hell out of Belgrade, Serbia, in order to save the lives of innocent Muslim civilians in Kosovo. Parenti says the reason that our military interventions and other foreign policies make no sense to you is that you're taking seriously the government's public statement of its noble purposes. Parenti advises that the actual motive and purpose of most of our policies is to increase the profits of the Fortune 500. And one of my favorite Parenti quotes, just because you don't know what they're doing doesn't mean that they don't know what they're doing. This is what I learned from Michael Parenti, and I believe he is right. For what it's worth, Parenti is now 82 years old. He gave a nice talk in Springfield, Illinois on October 6, 2015. It was titled Capitalism versus Reality. We shall hear the talk in good time, but today I'm going to broadcast parts of the question and answer session that followed. Parenti talks about whether universities and students can still be a force for progressive change. He talks about Senator Bernie Sanders. Sanders is a good liberal Democrat, Parenti thinks, but not much of a socialist. Parenti talks about the oppressiveness of Wall Street and whether socialism could possibly work. Here, speaking off the cuff, Parenti is in fine form. He's funny and witty and wise and very shrewd. The original sound recording was quite mediocre. I've been able to improve it, but there's still some audio distortion in places. He's speaking at a university, and the first question he is asked is whether universities can still be a force for progressive change, or are they hopelessly corrupted?
Well, that's another thing they did, that is they've taken students. Students have been a very political activist group, social group in America. If you go back to the Vietnam War, and you even go back during the Depression and such, students often showed up and fought for good causes. What we got now, though, are students who are getting crushed by debts. You know, it's hard to go out there and spend weeks organizing and such when you got $75,000 debt that comes up when you're going to graduate next week.
So the question was, with the privatization of public universities and universities in general, do you think that the university still has a role to play in what you called substantive democracy?
Yes. Universities throughout history, not just here, but in Europe and such, have always had a role to play. The youth are people who know the score. They are exposed to the contradictions of the situation, and they often have very idealistic commitments. They do. I remember that during the Vietnam War, I wasn't a student. I already was a teacher, and I would get up there, and we'd get on that line and face the cops down, and it wasn't for, and we were characterized as just a bunch of vandals, just a bunch of blowhards, and stupid, and obscene, and potheads, and so forth, and so on. I mean, so who do we face? We face these cops who are heavy drinkers and got clubs in their hands and wanna beat up defenseless. They're very brave. They're very brave when the other side has no armament or anything. Then they're ready to hit and kill, as we still see today, don't we? So my answer is yes. The plutocrats always saw the students as a problem, and as people who agitate and confront things, and there are too many of them all in once gathered all in one place, and that's dangerous. Did I answer your question somewhat? The board of trustees of these universities are just like the board of trustees from corporations. They're made up of big company guys, mm-hmm. General Motors, General this, General that, and the other thing. And they get paid the salaries. You know better than me about the recent times, right? They're getting paid quite a bit. I won't put you on the spot. I know you're still working here. That's right. It's good to associate now and then with someone who has a job, I can tell you. makes me feel good, you know.
The question is, what is Dr. Parenti's view of Bernie Sanders?
Well, Bernie and I were very close friends for years. He'd come over to my house when I lived in Washington, D.C. He came with his kid, with his son once, and my son was visiting me. I made them dinner. Bernie and I both ran on the Liberty Union ticket in Vermont. I ran for the House of Representatives. Vermont has only one congressman, so you can't get gerrymandered out. But it meant I'd go up and down the whole state, and I got 7% of the vote. Bernie ran for Senate, U.S. Senate. He got 2% of the vote. Not that I'm trying to be committed. And very close to Bernie. His last words to me, I remember when he came to, it was right in Berkeley, California, when I was living there. Bernie came to Oakland, and he said, "Where have you been? I haven't seen you. Stay in touch with me." I said, "Oh, sure, I will, Bernie." But then came the Yugoslav War, and Bernie sided with President William Clinton and supported the bombing of Yugoslavia, 78 days and nights. Depleted uranium, which has left Serbia today with the highest cancer rate in all of Europe. I vigorously opposed that war and wrote a book about it called To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. And Bernie, as I told Huck was a good friend, I forget Huck's last name, he was a professor from the university who took a leave to go work in Bernie's office when Bernie was now in the House of Representatives. Bernie went to the House of Representatives. He got elected mayor of Burlington and then House of Representatives and then the U.S. Senate. And now he's doing this try for the presidency. What was I saying? Just Yugoslav War, yeah. I said he's standing shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House and Bill Clinton and these creepos. For a war against these people like this. I said, and that's when I broke with him. I stopped sending contributions. I stopped. Furthermore, his salary was way bigger than what I was making. And So when I saw that he was running, you know, and I put on the little thing to see some of the events with 10,000 people, I must admit, I sat there, and it was very touching, and I was so happy to see it. I was very happy to see Bernie getting up there, 10,000 people, and the powers that be have to deal with him in some way now. It's like a big blister in the way, and they got to deal with him and say, well, blah, blah. And mostly they don't say too much. They just concentrate on Donald Trump. But, I think it's great. The trouble is he's still not saying anything about foreign policy. He's still not criticizing. The empire feeds off the republic. We don't need an empire with 700 military bases all over the world. We don't need to be fighting 2, 3, 4, 5 wars at the same time. This is crazy. That's all. Bernie hasn't said a word about those things. He hasn't. He's just not said anything about it. So he's good on local issues. He's really, I think, he's a liberal Democrat. He's not a socialist or not even really a left progressive. He's just sort of he'd be a good liberal Democrat. But look at what he says. He says, and we want the rich to pay their share too. What do you mean? We want to stop having the rich rule our lives and rule our minds. That's what we want, and I think he could do a lot better on that. And he's going to have to say it's not just me. I was alone years ago about his position on foreign policy, but a number of other people have brought it up now too. So he will have to start saying something about foreign policy, which would put him at odds with the National Security State boys who play for keep. When you get into arguments with them, you got to be careful about your plane crashing or your car skidding and going off the road or a lone assassin coming over and killing you, you know, as John Lennon happened to him, remember? And a few others, supposedly. Please stand up and speak louder because I'm 82 years old and I am 82 and I can't hear them.
The question is, what are some things that we can do to combat or counteract the control of capital, of money, over our lives? Is that fair? Okay, thank you.
We could go through this talk again and pick out things. We could get rid of the $40, $50, $60 billion direct subsidies that are given to corporate America for export supports, for equity freebies, all sorts of things that they get. Look at the farm bill every 2 years. My God, the payoff. And it doesn't go to poor Joe the farmer or Joe the plumber. It goes to big agribusiness, that's who. So you can stop doing that. You could start organizing. You could start organizing the work in a more communal and communitarian way. And we have evidence that Americans are quite capable of doing communitarian work. You don't have to be a Chinese peasant who does it from feudal times or something or other. People of all sorts are immediately see where their interests are, and they have skills and all that, and they could do those things. So that's what I would say. I would say we'd have to start moving away. Look, this system wouldn't survive if it wasn't the federal government pumping it and survive and giving it what it is. One of the things that the capitalist system needs, what the government is there for, is to protect the capitalists from the capitalists. As I said, one capitalist can kill many capitalists. It's a cannibalistic system too. So these are some of the things you would do, and there are others too. It's an interesting question. You could start. Because you already have people doing it. Gar Alperovitz has written a number of books on this about the worker communitarian ways that workers who own their own factories and work for non-profit, everybody gets a salary. So maybe some people who have more responsibilities and longer hours will get a little more salary. But there are thousands of workers in America who work in worker-owned businesses, and that could tell you then how it could be done, and they'd be perfectly Right, and with regulations to make sure that these products are safe, because you could have workers producing something that's not safe either, you know.
Question is to get some of your thoughts on the stock market, on financial capital.
It's shameful that people who have worked hard and saved their money then have to gamble it on the market because they realize they don't have enough, and they're going to drop dead in a year or two. They got to hope that they'll drop dead in a year or two so that they can not be penniless or end up out on the sidewalk. And so they go into the market and they do that. That's true. That's true of, and it's true that as people get older, but they're getting poorer, the way the system is rigged, that contradiction is going to get more intense. And the market becomes a place where people hope they can make money without working. That's what the capitalist does. And it's a big gamble. It's a big shoot. But the people who are most successful at it are the people who spend all their time with it and who have diversity of investments. The Warren Buffett's, you know, he's most successful. You guys all are going out and you're taking a dive and your stock is worthless. I'll buy it up. Why will I buy it up? I'll buy it up because I can get it for a penny. And then once it starts climbing back up again, I'll sell it. So you sell when your stuff is going high. You sell then, and when it's going low and it's going out, and then you buy those. That's what you buy. That's how Buffett made his billions. And so the whole thing becomes a casino game. You know, might as well go to Vegas because it's a terrible way to have to end your life struggling in that manner.
On New World Notes, we're hearing Michael Parenti speaking ad lib on economics and world affairs. He's in Springfield, Illinois, on October 10, 2015. There's a rambling, unfocused question, and Parenti's answer is a bit rambling, too. I think it's worth hearing, though, because it has some nice insights into socialism versus capitalism. Indeed, insights into some of the problems with socialism, at least the way socialism was practiced in Cuba and the Soviet Union. The questioner said that capitalism brings innovation, which we do need, and socialism cannot work because people are greedy and flawed. Michael Parenti responds.
It is because people are imperfect that you don't build a system that feeds their imperfections and harms their perfections. That people who want to help, want to do things, want to make it all fair and square, they get into trouble, they get unrewarded, they often get punished, whereas the people who pursue money in the most treacherous and amoral ways, they get benefited. And you're telling me about them. You're saying, we can't do without them. You got it in your brain that we can't do without the people who steal and deceive and plunder and produce and innovate. They do innovate in many ways. Adolf Hitler innovated too, and there was innovations in communist countries. I'm sure some of those things were. I went to Cuba and I saw things they did, and I saw other things they didn't like and all that. And it should be open and be able to be debated. That's why I called for services. Cuba's already doing some of that, services and such, instead of letting everything be held by the government. That's impossible. You can't do that. But the government, you need a government that is going to help parse out things fair and square. And I think they do. They do that. I was just thinking, for instance, one of the small businesses they have in Cuba are women's hairdressers, beauty parlors. There are women's beauty parlors. They're held in women's houses, you know, and all that. And it's allowed. And the communist government had to back off. You can't get, don't get between a woman and her hair, you know. A woman's hair is an ongoing dynamic all the time. And so you can see how innovations, you can see things that are wrong. I was talking about plumbers who were terrible in Cuba. They go and they fix here and leave it draining over there, and they don't care. They go home. Restaurants in the Soviet Union, restaurants. I mean, the last thing you want to do as a restaurant manager is have a big clientele that likes your food. They come a lot, and you got to serve it to them and all that. The less I have to serve out, the more I can take home and black market. That would be a kind of example of what you're talking about. Well, how do you stop that? Well, you can stop that. You can have social services. My position is where small business can operate, then have small businesses. And restaurants would be one example, because the last thing the restaurant owners in Russia wanted to do was to please a lot of people and serve them out. The less I served out, the more I had to sell on the black market or take home from my family or neighbors or whatever. It was a corrupt thing. And there are mythologies about it, too. I mean, they thought things were so perfect, and they weren't perfect. But don't forget, the Soviet Union, there's not a single socialist country that didn't produce its world not being under fire. They all were under fire all the time. The Soviet Union's history, you look at just about every year in its history, and there was a crisis, there was invasions from the West, there was wars, there was civil wars, there wasn't one normal year where these people could sit and work it out for themselves and for each other. They couldn't do that. And so they also would compensate with myths about their country. Like, I remember when I was in Moscow, our guide, she said, there's no prostitution in my country. I said, what? What? No prostitution? This is a country of, almost 400 million people at that time. No prostitution? I said, well, there may not be any prostitution in your country, but there's quite a bit in our hotel here. And then without missing a beat, she says, yes, I want you to know, all those girls have day jobs, and they work, too. I said, oh, that fixes, that settles it. There's a little extra change here. We could go on with your questions. Mm-hmm. And it's a good question, though, yeah.
Question about how does organization look when you're organizing to confront mythologies? Is that fair? So if a part of what we have to do is confront the capitalist mythology, how would we do it? What are some ways that we might be able to do that?
First thing is we have to inform ourselves about what's going on. What is Monsanto? Why do they do these things? Or why aren't these people being shot? You know, we have to ask those questions. No. Did I say that? I'm so tired.
Did I mention the mic was hot?
Yeah. Oh, I was on? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, Monsanto is a wicked, evil corporation. It really is among the worst. So you're saying that people are not developing a critical perspective of how this thing operates? Is that what it would... I remember a construction worker. It was in Vermont, as a matter of fact, back when I was doing union support work there. He looked at one of the brochures for the Liberty Union Party, which Bernie Sanders was running into. Took the paper and he saw our program. He says, these are all good ideas except this last one. You know what the last one had? It had a word socialism in it. That we could adopt certain forms of democratic socialism so that people can all participate. Blah, blah, blah. That he didn't know what the hell socialism was. He was accepting it in the actual content, public transportation, public utilities. But then he didn't. He was afraid of a word, and they've got us afraid. That's why I think it's really terrific of Bernie to come out and say, "Yes, I'm a socialist." But then when he gets into particulars, socialist means put a little more taxes on the rich, or put a lot more taxes on the rich, and less on people who can barely make it now. I mean, that any good liberal would support that, you would think, if there were still some good liberals left in American politics. I don't know.
One, two, three, four.
First, you have to have a problem. That part isn't hard. The second step is everybody realizing they're like you, they're holding the same card. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change. So quick. The congressmen and businessmen and TV sets will try hard to make sure it isn't so. You don't have a problem. If you do, it's not the same problem. And if it is, well, there's just nowhere you can go. But that many times the history is rich, though we easily forget how a meme can take hold and grab you. How it can spread out like a net, and everything can change so quick. They'll say we are lost or we're dreaming, or they'll make a dream for us. They'll try to come up with a good story about why we belong at the back of the bus, about why we belong in this position, about how we don't know what we meant, about how there most certainly isn't any such thing as the 99%, but everything can change so quick. Everything can change so quick.
David Rovics. And before that, Michael Parenti speaking ad lib on socialism, capitalism, universities, Russian prostitutes, Bernie Sanders, and whatnot. We'll have more, probably next week. Thanks to the University of Illinois at Springfield and to Dale Lehman of radio station WZRD for the original recording, which I have edited. Thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. Thanks to that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford, for making possible the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, whence New World Notes emanates more or less. Thanks to the dozen or so community broadcast stations, coast to coast, that also carry the show. And if hearing us on the air isn't convenient for you, you can always grab our podcast. You can grab it at the show's website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. This is Kenneth Doust. Thank you again for listening. Illegitimi non carborundum. Question authority, and please come back again next week. Ciao.